I think there might also have been, there was also positive construction in terms of collective dignity, social justice, freedom, change, these kinds of things. I'm wondering if the question might not actually be, do people want democracy, but what kind of democracy do they want? And there seems to be this notion of participation and of participative democracy. And I mean, you painted Syria in a kind of in a dark light, which makes a lot of sense considering current events. But perhaps there's a case study that might show why this sense of participative democracy might actually be the point. In Yabrud in Syria, which is a smaller city that was where the regime completely left a few months ago, it's a much less complicated case than something like Aleppo because of the size. But people have organized around councils and have basically reorganized the city, reorganized their lives in terms of this notion of democratic participation, and it works. Seems to work pretty well. So I'm wondering if we shouldn't be evaluating, if you think it's still a good thing to evaluate the success of revolutions in terms of how well they fit models of liberal, democratic, representative democracy.
I actually don't think we should be evaluating outcomes at all. I don't think that we know what the outcomes of any of these revolutions are going to be for at least 10 years. So at that point, I think that, you know, it's to say that, you know, Egypt has had a revolution and Saudi Arabia hasn't, it's just the wrong question, just to start with. In terms of participatory democracy, absolutely. I mean, there is very much that claim for particular substantive outcomes, justice, reform, participation, various kinds of things, often populist demands, which would cut against neoliberal economic reforms, very powerful in Tunisia and in Egypt especially. But then at the same time, there are kind of fundamental questions of representative democracy as well. So, you know, it's a real dilemma. If 70% of Egyptians want to vote for Islamists, does it matter that the 30% who don't want Islamists, should they be allowed to set the agenda? They really want to see a certain kind of society, they have passion for it, they're going to protest unless they get it, but at the same time, they lost the election. And so, in other words, it's easy to show ways where the things go run together, right? You want to have democracy and participatory democracy. What happens when they run against each other and you have to make those kind of deep value judgments between them? Do you prioritize the demand for justice or the outcomes of elections? And I would say that fundamentally that needs to be resolved by those societies themselves. They have to write constitutions which resolve those questions. And I think that's why the deeply flawed constitutional drafting process in almost every one of the transitional countries has been so alarming. That even in Libya, starting from scratch, they haven't been able to figure this out. In Tunisia, where people thought they were going to get it right, they haven't been able to. Don't even get me started on Egypt.
We have another question at the back there.
I just wanted to know, what do you think of the mainstream media manipulating the information?
In what sense?
Who's the question
who's
for?
Who's the question for?
It's not addressed to anybody in particular, any of the panelists. Just, like, I mean, like CNN not saying, like, the whole truth or maybe hiding some of the information.
Well, I mean, media has always been selective in what, I mean, it's sort of this long-term issue, right, on what media represents, does not represent. And the thing that Mark was thing raising earlier is that you have new structures rise up with new media. And I wrote this in a blog post very early on. I was looking at the sort of leaderless revolutions, and if you looked at it, there are very strong structures within it. It's a different kind of selectiveness, but there's strong hierarchical structures. So I think with the mainstream media, you had you have a different kind of selectivity, right? You have editors, you have political ideologies, you have institutional constraints because they're big corporations. With social media, you have very much a rich gets richer processes. So if somebody takes off on Twitter, they become even more important, and then, you know, then they get invited to appear on mainstream media, and then they have more Twitter followers. It can create these very strong hierarchies there as well. So I think the correct question is to look at sort of the biases of all of them, yeah, and I try to understand how do they differ from the past. So one thing I would disagree is that I wouldn't say that there's no change. I would agree that it's still, it's got a structure, it's got a hierarchy of what gets presented.
And I just want to highlight two points in response to your question. The first one is, when you talk about freedom of the media, freedom of the press, again, this is a continuum. You cannot just say, okay, these countries are completely free, and therefore people can say whatever they want, and in these countries people do not have any kind of freedom. Again, this kind of dichotomy, I think, is a false one. I think, like objectivity, freedom is very much a continuum, and there is no such thing as complete, total, you know, uncontrolled media in any part of the world, even in the United States or Europe, you know, which are known for press freedom or media freedom. There will still be certain constraints and certain regulations and certain, you know, do's and don'ts and things which could be said in the media and things which are, you know, colored or altered or even in some cases completely forbidden from being discussed or from being talked about in some media outlets. So again, it's a continuum rather than a black and white dichotomy. The other point is, you know, now we have a cacophony of voices. We have so many different types of media which are at play. That does not mean that the governments have given up their control over quote-unquote so-called mainstream media. It just means that more voices are being added to the field. And there are more, you know, diverse and different types of media which are now at play that were not there before. But there is still governmental control and interference in media systems in Arab countries, including the ones that are now going through transitional phases. We do not see that the Egyptian government, for example, has given up completely its control over media outlets in Egypt. There is still control, especially over national broadcast media outlets, but it's just that there are new avenues that are now at play that were not there before, more privatization in the media, and definitely more discussion and more conversation on social media outlets that was not there earlier.
I have to add one thing to that, though. One area where there's been a profound change is that it is, when it's done right, it's much easier for people to fact-check the mainstream media now. In other words, if the Egyptian state media says, there were no protests in Tahrir today, and people can then post, you know, 30 videos showing, hey, look, here's the protest, then I think it's more possible to push back on that.
Okay, there was a question here, and then there, and there.
Yes, yeah, so, something close to home. Al Jazeera, it's growing network. It's got an infinite amount of money, I understand, from where headquarters is located. It's not, maybe because we have only 5% of the population in North America. It hasn't made it here, but I think the real reason is the control of the three major networks aren't allowing Al Jazeera to come in North America, and I think they're doing a disservice to us because we're not getting the whole story unless you're on social media, which older folks like myself aren't that attached to. So what is stopping them from coming here? And they'll eventually come, I know. But at this moment, the other networks, it's controlled media in North America worse than in some of the countries you mentioned.
Sure. Yeah, I had a paper written on this when Al Jazeera English actually was launched in 2006, 10 years after the launching of Al Jazeera Arabic. I had a paper talking about, you know, can Al Jazeera English actually bridge the intercultural gap between the West and the Arab world, and how much proliferation and penetration could it have in Western societies, which is actually the mission or the goal of creating Al Jazeera English in the first place. And it does face a number of obstacles and challenges. One of them is the carryover or the spillover from the reputation of Al Jazeera Arabic. So some networks, especially cable networks, as you mentioned, would be hesitant or reluctant to carry Al Jazeera because of, you know, quote unquote, some of the negative stereotypes affiliated with it, showing the videos of Osama bin Laden, or some people called it, you know, the terror TV or the Al-Qaeda TV and all of that stuff. But then we have seen, I think, especially in the midst of the Arab Spring, a change in the image of Al Jazeera. We even saw the Secretary of State, the former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, commenting and saying, oh, we have really seen good journalism on Al Jazeera English. We hope that the American media would do the same in terms of covering, you know, political events and political, issues. So I think that there's now some kind of positive change in the image of Al Jazeera in general, and I do, you know, share your concern about the need to have Al Jazeera, being shown to a much wider global audience in order to be able to give a different, you know, version, a different side of media coverage of the events in the region that is not seen on quote-unquote mainstream American media.
But also you should note that Al Jazeera itself is coming under a lot of criticism, especially Al Jazeera Arabic, from the region, because it is seen, Sultan Al-Qasimi has been arguing this, is that it's very pro-Ikhwan, pro-the Muslim Brotherhood, so that it's censoring certain news. Now, I mean, you can judge for yourself, but it's not like, you know, it'll be this perfect media environment. I mean, the thing is, there's 24 hours in the day, and you only have a certain amount of attention, so any kind of media filtering will come with some kind of structuring and some kind of bias and some kind of criterion for what gets reported and what gets not. So I think it's rather than look for the perfect media, which won't exist just because there are only so many hours in the day, we should try to understand, so where is each of these, what do they come with? What's the package?
Well Murdoch and his Fox Network.
I'm just going to go into another question. Thank you.
Hi. I was just wondering if you could comment if you think that social media has taken and started to pressure actors into being more extreme in their positions, either under constitutional processes in the countries that have recently gone under government change, and also geopolitically, say, in the conflict in Syria with the actors who are actually engaged in conflict there.
I think there are pressures towards kind of ideological purity, you know, kind of the self, the policing of community boundaries and punishment of people who deviate from that. That probably, it might lead towards more extreme positions, but I would say that, I would more say it leads to more rigid positions, which make compromise more difficult, just generally speaking, kind of the polarization dynamics that I was talking about before.
You should look at the Todd Gitlin book I mentioned, The Making and Unmaking of the New Left. It's quite interesting in how the media activist relations had the same effect, because you got on television, if you carried a Viet Cong flag or burned the U.S.
Right.
flag, I mean, the more extreme and flamboyant your action was. I mean, a lot of times the way to attract attention has been the spectacle, and the spectacle itself has all sorts of political consequences if that's how you're acting. So it's not a, you know, once again, the mechanism in question is not a social media versus not, but how does social media alter how this plays out?
Yes. I think this is probably
my question is for Mr. Mark Lynch. As I live in Western democracy, actually, and I'm Egyptian, the first thing I learned that the democracy is consists in balance between plausibility and accuracy, and it's never-ended state. So as long as justice is not delivered yet in Egypt, Egyptians are experiencing plausibility rather than accuracy that exceeds the burden of only one government. This is my question.
I'm not sure I understand. Responsibility
the Egyptians are actually experiencing the plausibility of democracy, not the accuracy. So they need too much government to experiment this plausibility rather than one government that keep only the burden of the whole. My comments, it's a comments for social media. Social media did shift the performance of mainstream media in Egypt because they serve as sources for lining with the versions of the social media to put their own views on the events, the things they cannot afford before on commenting the events. And they are linking now with activists, and they take versions of the events through this. And the social media put accountability and check on the council, the military council through the transition that keeps that kept them out of violence and keeping regulations in transition. Thank you.
Does anyone want to respond to that comment?
I would just say that it gets back to some of the discussions that we were having before, that this is very much an incomplete transition at this point. And I think demands for justice for the martyrs of the revolution, demands for meaningful change, are not going to stop until you actually get meaningful change. And I think one of the deepest tensions in Egyptian politics right now is that the elected Muslim Brotherhood government wants to say, the revolution is over, we've won, and let's get on with normal politics. and many of the revolutionaries and activists say, no, there's a long way to go. They simply disagree about that. But I think you're right. As long as that gap remains, you're not going to have a stable system. I mean, there's no question about it.
And it brings us back again to the idea of, you know, the work is not done yet, the work is not finished. You know, it's not like, you know, as Mark's saying, you know, that we can just move on because the revolution has now succeeded. In fact, one of the slogans that the activists are raising in Egypt is the revolution is still going on, thawra mustamirra, right? Revolution is still going on. You know, just to keep the new government in check, right, and have, you know, checks and balances and make sure there's accountability, like you mentioned, just reminding people that, you know, social media alone as tools, again, cannot bring about this transformation or change that's needed, that there is still a lot of work that needs to be done on the ground, right, and offline, and more organization and structure needs to be in place, and that all has to take place through interpersonal face-to-face communication, not just through Twitter and blogs and Facebook.
But I would say that the checks and balances should come from an elected parliament, and it's the absence of institutional checks and balances, which I think has Egyptian politics so destabilized. They have no other way to express their opposition rather than to go out into the streets. And if they actually had a parliament, I think things might look different.
Well, so, all revolutions at some point end up sacrificing. I mean, there's a balance between justice and peace that everybody kind of ends up striking. And it's never a perfect one, whichever one you have. I mean, look at South Africa, you look at Guatemala. Every single one comes with a solution that just isn't satisfying. But I don't think there's a way out of that.
No.
I think on that note, we'll end. Thank you very much to the three panelists.